Hello, friends. I am in the middle of the esoteric astrology adventures around program 102, which is really probably 140 hours or so into the process. But I have interrupted that process a little bit here to continue our discussion on identification. I suppose maybe it was almost a year ago that I made some programs on identification. It is something which is strongly entering my consciousness at this time. I suppose on an autobiographical note, I would say that there is a strong Uranus conjunction to my Sun in Aries, which I've never had before in this life, and at the same time a Pluto square. So from an esoteric astrological perspective, this involves the head center, ruled by Uranus, and the base of the spine center, ruled by Pluto. It also involves other things, of course. Different chakras are involved. But it turns my mind, or my consciousness, towards the essence of things. I hope you'll excuse me if I don't sort of patter along the way I often do when doing astrology discussions, because I find that this subject is much harder to talk about. And why am I talking about it at all when perhaps in one sense it cannot be discussed, and every human being has to himself, herself, find the way into this kind of consciousness, this kind of merging, melting, this entering of a certain pervasion by all things of reality. I suppose there is a compulsion to discuss it, just as has been the case with mystics in the previous years. They always wanted to talk about union with God. And I think that if I would compare what I may say with those old mystical discussions, maybe there's really not so much difference. Maybe it's just a question of terminology. But perhaps the sense of things within the consciousness is very much the same. For a number of years now, I've been writing in these little black books. Here they are. I find that I can control my thoughts better when I use them. I may have mentioned that I probably have 165, 175 large books that I've written in over the years. And I have them all in storage somewhere, detailing the processes that I've gone through for maybe 40 years or more. Probably there's not so much of interest in them. What is important is the harvest of it all after a time. And I hope I've reached that point in my life when I'm able to begin harvesting some of these, the fruits of some of these developmental processes. I seem a bit obsessed with this subject at the present time. There's so many things to do, you know, with the university and with the Moria Federation and there are those duties which one must attend to, and yet I seem to be compelled to go deeper and deeper into this subject. It's a strange kind of thing, you know, one has all these things to do, and one sits down for a couple of hours, and one can feel guilty about not doing something. I suppose it's a third-ray liability, and I have plenty of that ray, I think. Nobody knows for sure, I suppose, you know, the rays of past lives and the rays mediated by the astrological factors in the chart can be perhaps different from the ray chart. So we have certain estimations that we make, and we use them as working hypotheses. And that may be what we can do at the present time until such an authority as the Tibetan, who is very responsible, I think, for bringing the ray science to humanity, gives us his sight on our rays. So I've been compelled, it seems. We have a beautiful little temple here that my wife, Tuya, has created over the years with the help of co-workers, and it's a wonderful space. And I sometimes find myself repairing to the temple just to think, just to get into this stage of perception and understanding, and I would even call it identification, which seems a necessity in my life at this time. And then, of course, if I don't do that, and I just plow on with the duties and so forth, this voice, this inner demand for breaking through into some greater realization puts pressure upon me. And that pressure builds up. You know, in your horoscope, when you have Uranus and Mars conjuncted, the progressed Mars and the transiting Uranus, it's a breakthrough kind of situation where the boundaries that previously hemmed in the consciousness are no longer seen as acceptable. So something, you know, we're all spirit, every one of us, and that immortal identity wants to be recognized for what it is by its lower projection, the immersed consciousness, the what I call the prakritically immersed consciousness. It wants to be recognized so that that lower consciousness recognizes what it really is. That is the immortal, deathless, birthless spirit. The one reality, which we all essentially are. So my mind has, I have a particular method. I think we all have different methods. Nobody can construct the antikarana, the bridge to reality, if I can call it that, thoroughly at least, on the instructions of another. It's a unique undertaking, I think, for every human being. And Master DK has given us an amazing launching pad with the six stages of building the antikarana. It is, as I've sometimes said, I think a very second-ray method involving visualization and words of power and so forth. And I think it is suitable for everybody up to a point. And at that point, a certain type of uniqueness of approach will take over. And who knows what that will be? I wonder if anyone of us knows what that will be for ourselves. I mean, I've sometimes talked about the first ray method as asserting one's being, and clearing the field of consciousness of all extraneous perceptions, arriving at a point of tension which is so extreme that it breaks through into the realization of the presence, reality. It is a neti-neti method, not this, not that, not this, not that, rejecting everything that one usually identifies with, and finding through that rejection, perhaps, the only thing or no thing that really is. Substance. Not substance in the sense of matter, but that which substands all factors within this great illusion we call the universe, at least to our type of consciousness. It is a great illusion. So the great illusion, I believe, is universal. That with which we are presented in consciousness is not necessarily reality. Ultimately, all things are reality, but it is a seeming, an illusory presentation of a deeper substance, some indefinable factor. Maybe the Buddha called it suchness, because it really could not be described in other terms. There are other names for it, perhaps essence, being, pure being, self, synthesis, that. I've sometimes drawn a picture of a big O with two little quotation marks around it, single quotes, because, you know, you're dealing with something that you are calling by a certain symbol, but it really isn't that. So that, for me, sometimes is my way of representing this life, if I can call it that, for which we are searching. It's the very heart of the monad. It's the very heart of everything, or it's the reality of the monad and the reality of everything. It's not what we call the monad per se. The monad per se is a certain state of encapsulated being within a cosmic etheric envelope made of substance of the second subplane of the cosmic physical plane. It's a special case of reality, and by no means the highest case, though for man it seems to be the highest. And then, of course, there's the liberated volatile essence, which creates its envelope on the logoic plane, I think, and is one of three greater beings. But that's another discussion on the monad. Suffice it to say that the heart of the monad, or the very center of it, is life itself, and that life is indistinguishable from every other life, regardless of what form that life may produce. So we have these words, you know, that try to say something to us about what we are trying to realize. We can call it life, essence, the one, the self, the synthesis, the substance, the eternal, reality itself, different names. in my book on infinitization, it's almost a joke, but I have something like 241 names for the nameless. I realize the paradoxical situation I'm in, because one cannot name suchness, I mean, without somehow defeating the perception of it, or defeating one's realization that one is it. And yet there's something about the mind that demands that we put a symbolic label upon it, perhaps to as much to clarify what it is not as to reveal what it is. I mean, every naming is in a way a veiling of reality. Reality has no name. Stages of the expression of that reality have names. But reality per se has no real name. A name would be a definite limitation upon something which can have no limits. In a way, one just has to, you know, stop talking about it, except for the, and be it, except for the compulsion to talk about it, and to help those who have forgotten what they are, who have forgotten that it is, to begin remembering that it is, and they are it. You know, it sounds so platitudinous in some ways. I have a friend to say, hey, it's all one, ain't it? You know? I mean, he's joking, of course. And it is, but he's referring to the way that people glibly say, well, it's all one. And talk about oneness. Talk about it, you know. But the intensifications of the experience of oneness still elude them. And I'm sure, I have this faith that there are intensifications of the realization of oneness that far, far transcend what a human being can ever achieve along that line. What I was getting at was that these great beings that we presume to exist, if we study with care and with faith the ageless wisdom, the planetary logoi, the solar logoi, cosmic logoi, supercosmic logoi, on and on, galactic logoi, supergalactic logoi, etc., ever greater wholes, they are unitive beings and unitive consciousness that must have a far more intense realization of the oneness of all things than is possible for a human being. I mean, sometimes we human beings, we make ourselves the measure of all things, and we think that our enlightenment comes with the kind of a realization of a certain nirvana capable to the human being, and that's it, as if there will be no more. But I just see a process of ever-increasing depth of realization and of identification and of, well, as the Tibetan says, it's not just onward moving in consciousness, he onward moves in life. Probably, you know, what he would say, a meaningless phrase to us. And we would look at these greater beings, realizing they have onward moved in life far more than we have, and that the intensification, the intensity of their realization of the oneness and of being the one is just exponentially greater than our own. And yet they have their limitations, because the whole universe is limited as far as I can see. I think of it as a one in contrast with the infinite indefinite, if I may call it that. The absolute infinitude in which there is nothing that ever could be accomplished or externalized that has not already been so within itself. In other words, there's nothing new under the absolute central spiritual sun, the way I see it. And there are all these questions about why then this externalization of the great breath we call the universe, and I don't think any human being can answer that. I've tried to say a few things about the law of contradiction, you know, that in order to be itself forever, it has to contradict itself periodically. But even that's not a contradiction. Well, I don't want to get too far into that kind of thinking, except to say that I wonder whether even the universal logos, which I see as what I call an absolute infinitesimal, the greatest of things next to nothing, or maybe I should call it the least of things next to nothing. I think all presentations in the presence are absolute infinitesimals, completely equal to each other. And there is no magnitude, nothing greater, nothing less. When you divide it by absolute infinitude, you get the same, what's it called, dividend? I have to check, you know, there's the divisor, the quotient, the dividend, the result. Divide anything by reality, or compare it with reality, and you always get the same thing. Something that's infinitely next to nothing. One day I'll be able to work out the math for that, but not in this life. It's simply an intuition. So you kind of wonder whether even the universal logos, and there have been countless of them, as rays of the absolute, the one ray of the absolute, going forth at the founding of every universe, becoming the universe, whether that embodied ray is not really infinitely removed from that from which it came. And whether even that logoic being, consciousness, intelligence, can conceive of that from which it came. Because every one, that is, every specificity, every definiteness, is, as I say, an ultimate infinitesimal or an absolute infinitesimal, the least possible quantity that is not zero. Some people say that it's indeterminate to divide by zero, and indeterminate to divide by infinity. But we are a long way from the realization of ultimate reality, even while necessarily being it all the time, forever, without beginning and without end. And some little reflection of this unappreciable ultimate reality, at least I suspect it's not appreciable in universe. I suspect that whatever we grasp of reality, however much greater it may be than that which we presently conceive, is infinitely removed from ultimate reality. And I know there are varieties of infinity, apparently. So when I say infinitely removed, I'm not being specific about it. I'm just saying that there's a great gulf between the one, and the one is any definiteness, and the indefinite zero, or the absolute infinity. And when you compare any definiteness with the ultimate indefiniteness, you get what I call the absolute infinitesimal. It seems like an ever-moving quantity than which there can be no smaller quantity. So size ends up not making any difference. Magnitude, we're either the zero or the one, or we're either the absolute infinity or the one, and really they are the same. But somehow, right here and now, we try to appreciate something of this ground of all being, as it has been called. I think it's a Paul Tillich, the theologian. I think that's his term. That's an ancient idea, even connecting with the music of the ancient Hindus, Brahmins, Vedists. The music has this pedal tone, and from it all things arise, or their writing has this bar, and from it all letters descend. We're looking for this ground of all being, this substratum. I call it substance. I never thought I'd develop a partiality for the word substance, because it always seems so material. It seems like the matter which underlies the more obvious matter, and that matter which is substanding obvious matter is also itself substanded, and on and on and on, almost ad infinitum, until the ultimate reality is the ultimate substance of a nature indescribable, except that there's nothing else than it. So it is the infinitely refined whatever words cannot express. But that's what we are, and the ancient Hindus, the ancient Brahmins in the Upanishads, the ancient Vedic thinkers were trying to tell us that. Thou art that. I was in downtown Finland today. My wife had an appointment, and I was wandering around, had a little tea, thought about some things in my little black book here. Then I just took a walk on the street, and then all of a sudden there's this shop. It's a yoga shop. I never saw it before. It's called Shankara. I said, whoa, there we go. Because Shankara has been my great inspiration. Back in the old days, early 90s, 1991, working with Keith Bailey and other fellow Masons at establishing the AUM, Ancient Universal Mysteries, we were having meetings, and the name of this book, The Crest Jewel of Discrimination, came up. And there are a number of translations of it. I'm not even sure I have the best one by any means. Many. It's a little book. And Master DK said, look, my students, I want each one of you to have this book. In a certain translation, was it Chowdhury or something? There are many translations. And that began me on a great quest. 1991, I got a copy, a little flimsy little paperback copy of The Crest Jewel of Discrimination. Well, it was radical. Radical. And I tuned in with probably something I've been thinking about for thousands of years, maybe. And I, using my sort of third-ray love of neologisms, I called the philosophy I was evolving, which is really nothing new, I called it radical infinitism. Radical infinitism. And I wrote a big book, which my son, the philosopher, said, Dad, you've written this book now, and you're going to spend the rest of your life trying to explain it. So, you may have been right about that. few years later, I wrote a book called On the Monad, which was my attempt to stick closer to Master DK's terminology, because I had departed greatly in infinitization of selfhood. I said, well, I'll use my own language here. And I used a language maybe that was closer to Shankara than to Master DK. And when I saw this Shankara bookstore today, I just had to go in and just had to buy a book on the Upanishads, translation of the major Upanishads. It was like a homecoming. And I felt good about it. You know, as if back to the roots, because for me, in a way, Shankara is the root. He had a strong first ray, and also a very strong second ray. I think, whereas the Buddha had a combination of rays 3-2-1, Shankara's rays had the 1 and the 2. They both may have been second-ray souls. Not sure about the monadic ray of Shankara. Pretty much, if you study a treatise on cosmic fire, one sees that the Buddha's monadic ray is the third. It's almost an inescapable conclusion. So we have to understand that third ray in a much higher way. When you think about this, the Buddha in whom the seeds of the previous solar system ripened, and who was also from the moon chain. It seems that he was, could well be, a nomad, a wandering monad from the previous solar system, maybe. But anyway, he found himself on the moon chain, and the seeds of the first solar system, or first major solar system, ripened in him. Amazing thought. And they have given us Shankara and the Buddha. I think Master M talked about them as being the two hemispheres of one whole. The way the Tibetan describes it, it seems that Shankara came after the Buddha. In the reappearance of the Christ, he gives kind of a sequence of teachers. And but, you know, a number of people take the same teacher name, like the Yoga Sutras, Patanjali. How many Patanjali were there? The first great Patanjali was maybe 10,000 years ago as an initiate, and other people have taken that name. Thus it could be with Shankara, and there are many Buddhas as well. It's a statement about a stage of consciousness that you reach and an office that you fulfill. And somehow, you know, beyond the mind, beyond our normal reasoning about things, because of the spirit that we are, the reality that we inwardly are, being the essence of the monad itself, we have a thirst for re-becoming what we have ever been, re-becoming in consciousness what we have ever been. We can't stop being it, you know, and there's a part of us in this indivisibleness. So there can be no parts, but okay. There's a part of us that knows that all the time, and that even now sees the illusion of all that we are passing through. All is illusion, O dweller in the shadows. Come forth into the light of day. Display the hidden glory of the Blessed One, the glory of the One and Only. The glory and the truth will rapidly destroy that which has veiled the truth. The prisoner can go free. So this is from a Ray 3 stanza. Wonder if I can find that, you know. The glory and the truth will rapidly destroy that which has veiled the truth. The prisoner can go free. So it's the Blessed One. It's the Ray 3 monad. The rending of the blinding veil, the clear pronouncing of the truth and practice right, will render to the Blessed One, that is the monad in extension, that golden thread, which will provide release from all the maze of earth existence. Wonderful. Wonderful. I would really recommend the Blessed One stanzas, which are occurring there. I'm going to do an analysis of these one day. It's 37, page 37, beginning page 36. Individualization and the seven ray types. The monad is what is individualized. And this gives us, as we will discover if we carefully read, an understanding of how the monad projects itself, how the spirit projects itself. Being descends to manifest. You know, time is. Being descends to manifest. Creation is. Time then and form agree. Being and time do not agree. Here we have page 285 of Discipleship in the New Age, and these marvelous stanzas. Here it is, stanza 2, page 284, 285. Time is, being descends to manifest, creation is, time then and form agree, being and time do not agree. This is the seed of all philosophies. This is very Shankaric. And fundamental. So I would really recommend that, everybody. You know, study page 285, 284, 285 of Dyna 2, Discipleship in the New Age, Volume 2, and discover the seed of all philosophies for yourself. There comes a time when we have to awaken. We have to live a dual life, of course. Even the great masters and beyond live a dual life. They know what they are. They are identified as what they are. They dwell in isolated unity. It's a marvelous term, isolated unity. It's the unity of all things that is isolated in the consciousness. I mean, sometimes DK deplores the terms he has to use, and maybe sometimes he has said about isolated unity that it's not necessarily the best term that he ever used. He despairs of using words that will induce in us the realization of reality. But to me, isolated unity, it's a good term. And I love the idea of isolating the unity in all diversity while still perceiving the diversity as necessary to deal with the illusory diversity. And yet, never for a moment is that golden thread of isolated, of the unity, relinquished. So one lives beyond the vicissitudes, the fluctuations, the sine wave of up and down. In my own chart, I have a lot of Aquarius energy. Mars and the Moon, both in Aquarius, so I'm an Aries type, sun sign. Mars is one of the rulers, there it is in Aquarius. So Cancer rising, Moon is one of the rulers, there it is in Aquarius, and they stand together. So all those ups and downs, you know, the exaltations and the depressions, up and down, that he talks about. Where in the Aquarius chapter, the sunny heights when all is known and the deep valleys of shadow and depression. I've experienced those. I'd like, you know, and he tells us that those are the fluctuations of the form nature that cannot quite stand the intensity of unremitting reality, the presence of unremitting reality. The form will withdraw, and the form will reapproach and withdraw, and we become a flickering light in that sense. Or can we become a steadily approaching sun, growing in intensity? This is something for all of us to work out. You might well ask, you know, where am I going with this discussion? It's not like this is systematically organized. I've got many little black books here that are just filled with, you know, 1,000, 1,500 notes and all the rest, and I could go through them systematically and so forth. But I'm doing maybe the courageous thing here, like my friend Lawson Bracewell, who says he never knows what he's going to say before he says it. And that's kind of the case at the moment. I just wanted to sit down a little bit and discuss with you reality. as I understand it or don't understand it, but, you know, the attempt to reveal something about the oneness, the allness, something about that, that at moments I seem to understand and perhaps more than understand, become, and perhaps more than become, be. Be. I must be an old magician from way back, something. More along the third way line, but I love magical words. And, you know, one day the real mantrams will be returned to us when we are worthy of possessing them. Right now, maybe we don't really have those real mantrams. There are so many that are words of power that we don't have. Maybe we once had them. Maybe we abused them. At least the words that can command the elementals, I think we abused those in Atlantean days. And words of power will be returned to us as we prove our worthiness to receive them. But I love to make up magical words. It's so deeply rooted in me, I don't know even where it came from. But, you know, I love acronyms and magical words, which have the chance of inducing in the consciousness a realization which may not have been there before the magical word was pronounced. I evolved my own language. It wouldn't mean anything to anybody else, maybe. To me, it does. I use them as magical triggers to induce unaccustomed perceptions and identifications. Sometimes I wake up in the morning, you know, and I've been thinking the night before, really in it, really knowing. Wake up in the morning, oh, where's the alignment? You know, where's last night's realization? Well, it's just the form, isn't it? It's the form retreating from the pressures of the consciousness of the next level of reality. The form will retreat. And so the method of inducing the return of the realization has to be found. We all have to find it, as I was saying about building the Antikrana. Maybe it's kind of a third-ray method in a way, you know, using the throat, the voice, the sound to induce presence of reality. And, you know, you maybe, if we say Om Mani Padme Hum, hail to the jewel and the lotus, it's a profound mantra. It will induce a connection if we use it wisely with the right realization and visualization. There are other mantras, many. These phrases are said to be trumpeted words, trumpeted sounds. Each phrase out of the six has its own symbol at the close of each unit of thought, if I might call it that. These I may not give you, or the chords upon which the phrases go forth. Chord progression is implied in music. I tried to indicate one of the meanings of the formula, but have not given a translation or a paraphrase. Bear in mind as you ponder these six sentences, bear this in mind and try to give them an interpretation, which will come to you from the world of meaning, producing a practical application. From the world of causes, producing an enlightened understanding, and if you are far enough along, from the world of being, producing inclusiveness. These formulas have naught to do with personalities or with souls and deep incarnation. identified with form in the three worlds. They concern world movement, great and universal developments, and human progress as a whole towards the divine. You cannot yet think in those terms, but you can at least attempt to do so and grow thereby. It's beautiful. Older than the stanzas of Zen. Zen, much older. There's emanating sounds here. And there is a statement here of, can't find it at the moment, but it's about, I think he said, let's just see if I can find this. Trumpeted words. I seem to remember those phrases. Yep, here it is. The meaning underlying the symbology. It's going to put before us ancient symbols or symbolic writings. This difficulty is well nigh insurmountable in connection with this third formula. The reason for this is that this formula has been preserved as sounds. Or if I may use so ambiguous a phrase, as trumpeted words. It has not been committed to inscription. It's marvelous. Sometimes I will really discuss these in detail. But it's there are ways of getting into a deeper level of reality than we presently can access. And I've sometimes used the method of acronyms. I like it when acronyms can spell a kind of a magical word, or a word that has a meaning to me and will help me invoke, maybe evoke, cause an evocation of the presence of a state of consciousness which was not there before. Now, of harmlessness, DK tells us, harmlessness is the expression of the life of the man who realizes himself to be everywhere. Omnipresence. Everywhere. Nowhere that he is not. Who lives consciously as a soul. Presumably the soul has that type of realization. Whose nature is love. Whose method is inclusiveness. And for whom all forms are alike in that they veil and hide the light, and are but externalizations of the one infinite being. Wow. All forms are alike in that they veil and hide the light supernal, the greatest light, the ultimate substance of cosmos, because we are all of one substance. All of one Father, Mother, light. The subtle foundation of our appearance in form. Externalizations of the one infinite being as well. There is only one infinite, truly infinite. We can talk about varieties of infinity, but let's just be simple about it. One truly, ultimately infinite being, and every unit of life is an externalization of that foundational substratum, ultimate substance, ultimate infinite being, indefinable, and the only thing that ever is. We are all that. Now, as I say, there are intensities of the realization of that fact. That is the fact. When one says, I assert the fact, sometimes it seems to me that's the only fact worth asserting. For me, it's the ultimate fact that we are all externalizations of the one infinite being. So, how do we recognize this? We are given the sense of sight and touch and hearing, smell, taste. This is the contact we have with the apparently external world and a whole configuration, the whole presentation in consciousness is impressed upon us, and these senses are carried to higher levels, as we are told in the treatise on cosmic fire, you know, right around 188, you will see this. That is that 188. Oh, that's discipleship in the New Age. Can't do that. Here it is. Yep, and we have the hearing, touch, feeling, sight, taste, smell, and going on to all of the different levels, allowing us to contact the not-self and have some presentation of its nature given to our consciousness. And this is just the beginning. But whatever is presented to our consciousness, but we are all externalizations of this being, and we are all brothers in the externalization. No matter what you encounter at any level of the senses, it's never going to be anything other than a presentation of a modification of the one substance, and ultimately of the one substance itself. Now, you know, I'm not using the word substance in the material sense. I'm using it as that which substands. So no matter what it is, whether it's this cup from which I'm drinking tea, or this pen, this body, those trees, states of emotion, the sensations I feel touching something, the concrete images passing through my mind, or words, realizations, they're all presentations to consciousness of one thing. I suppose one of our first tasks is to be in unity with all human beings, to realize all human beings as one being. It's pretty hard if we get caught up in quality, because in quality there are so many distinctions, some of which are attractive, some of which are repulsive. So beyond the distinction between attraction and repulsion lies reality itself. It's in a way beyond good and evil. We often call good that to which we are attracted, and we often call evil that which repels us. But somehow, neither of those pairs of opposites is what reality is. This is the story, this is the story of brotherhood. All of one essence. You can't really call it father or mother. You have to call it father, mother. And we're all externalizations of this great father, mother, light, reality, being. So then, what are we when we encounter any presentation of consciousness? We call it a content of consciousness. Any content of consciousness, what are we? Well, we are that. And especially a human being. You know, you look at a human being, we have all these, we've known many people before in this human form, and we are attracted to some, repelled by others, and different to others. But I use the acronym B. B, of course, that in itself is a powerful word. We cannot help but be. Be what? Maybe doesn't make so much difference in the ultimate sense. It does make a difference in terms of our progression spiritually, but in the ultimate sense, we simply are. And people need to be reminded with the word be. But sometimes lately, or more specifically this afternoon, I use this acronym, B. And I used it in this way. Brother externalization. B. Brother externalization. Meaning when I see a human being, I mean I could say sister externalization too, but the conventional term is brotherhood. And I don't think of it in terms of the division of the sexes at all. When I see a human being, I call out to that human being in my mind, brother externalization. Which means I look at another human being with absolute equality on the level of essence. The essential human being is identical with every other human being on the level of essence, on the level of fact, on the level of substance, on the level of oneness, on the level of synthesis. Brother externalization. So I practice these things. See here, this is the thing. We've got to practice. The form demands practice. It's a seventh-ray thing. The repetition of influence at certain cyclic intervals will gradually make the desired impression, but only if we practice. Practice makes perfect. If we're playing the piano, you know, we set a certain time aside, we practice, and we repeat, and we repeat, until it becomes ingrained and the brain responds. Brother externalization. B. You know, maybe silly, but for me, I want to look on every human being beyond the what of the human being. Beyond the what. I want to look at that human being in terms of not what, but that. That the human being is at all. That this externalization stands before my perception and exists whatsoever. Brother externalization. In a way, I don't care what you are, or what anybody is, or what they've ever been. In my in-universe mind, of course, I have to care, and there will be the principle of hierarchy to deal with. Inevitably, in time and space, and beyond what we normally call time and space, there is hierarchy. I'm not thinking hierarchically now. I'm thinking in terms, maybe in a Libran sense, of total equality. Total equality in essence. Total equality in fact. Total equality in being. In substance. In God. In reality. Total equality. I want to be able to identify that before I get down into the what, all the distinctions of quality, where this stands on the hierarchy, what you have achieved, what I have achieved, what anyone has achieved in this relative world. I want to go beyond relativity into that rather than what. So I practice. I see someone on the street, brother externalization. Whoever it may be, brother externalization. All the same. And of course, I could extend this to any presentation, any content of consciousness. Brother externalization, B. Brother externalization, eternal. Sister eternalization, externalization eternal. C. B. To remind myself, a magical word to remind myself of what I'm really looking at here. Now I know, you know, that if I were to hold this to the hour, I would stop right now. But I think that since I haven't planned what I'm going to say, and since I'm pretty much saying what comes to my mind, I won't observe the usual time cutoff. I want to make all things equal. All things are equal. I want to realize it. I want to be that. I want to be that equality. Be that substance out of which all things forever are projected into the consciousness of the perceiver, whoever that perceiver and whatever that perceiver may be. The ground of all being is persistently present as the presence. The presence. Brother externalization in the presence. As the presence. Not is but me. You as me. Yum. Tum, that as me. Tum, this as me. Yum, it as me. Yum, you as me. Atum, all things as me. Etam, everything as me. Am, all as me. Not is but me. This is not egoism, this is the defeat of the lower ego. This is the dissolution of the conventional boundaries of ego, lower ego, and really of any ego, ego. Any ego, even the universal ego, has to be a distortion, a limitation. At least theoretically, we will say that, until we experience the awaiting intensities of identification. IOI, intensities of identification. It'll be enough for us to find that particular intensity of identification which a human being can achieve. The Buddha at the sixth degree, I believe, achieved a great intensity of identification, so that he lived perpetually in suchness. Doesn't make any difference what you call it. Presence, suchness, being, self, synthesis, substance, the eternal, many things. In my little black book here, I've got all kinds of things. Names for the nameless. Doesn't make any difference what you call them, they're all wrong, except if they can trigger the realization, the identification, the penetration, the pervasion. The presence pervades all imaginary things. Every presentation of consciousness, every content of consciousness is pervaded by the only thing that is. And somehow dissolve into presence, dissolve into being, dissolve into the fact, dissolve into self, into synthesis, into substance, dissolve, melt, merge. Very Neptunian, really. This business of identification. It's a planet which seems to destroy the boundaries within which we identify our definite self. What we really need is to discover the indefinite self, indefinite self, which we always are and even now know we are at a certain level of abstraction. Be brother externalization. then in that identicality with all perceptions, with all contents of consciousness, in that identicality, one can find the cohesive factor, find love in the depth of identicality. Find the cohesive factor which holds all contents of consciousness together. Find love in the depths of identicality. And maybe, you know, as the identicality presents itself, or is realized, or the great pervasion is somehow perceived, become, been, something in the heart will click. And it will be the factor that reveals the fact that reveals any factor as the same. And it will be a kind of cohesion, a kind of inescapable magnetism of love, which reveals the identification, the identicality presented as form within the field of love. And you don't want to have identicality without love. You may master some apprehension of identicality, that one is an externalization of the one infinite being, okay, but also that quality of loving the presentation. Not only being the presentation, which is maybe the ultimate, but loving it as well, meeting every presentation in the field of love. You can't love every form, but you love the form because you know it's of the essence. There are many out-of-alignment forms. Many personalities, DK even called them wicked or evil. Out of alignment with the archetype. I'm not going to love the form for what it seems to be. You're going to love the form for what it is. And there's a motion in the heart, a registration in the heart that confirms that love of the presented form, that externalization of the one infinite being. But I think it does take practice, you know. I think an idea is an idea, a thought is a thought, may graze the consciousness and may kind of cause a little ripple, a little stir in the consciousness. But then its power to promote alignment may be gone the very next day, unless there is a real practicing in the repeated use of these words of power. Word of power may be temporarily effective, but we want it to be always effective. We want it to be a name which calls the energy, which calls the realization, which summons the realization into consciousness so that one can live in an uninterrupted manner within the state of being, within the fact, within the presence, and not only within, but as the fact, as the being, as the presence. I sometimes substitute the word as for is. You as me, not just you are me, or you are I, not is but, well, which is the correct grammatical form. We have been given not is but me. Perhaps it is not is but I. But we'll go by with what we've been given. The power of the evocative word to summon the realization of the fact of identicality in being. That's what we want. That's what we seem to lack in our state of immersion into lesser consciousness. And we want to summon that. We want to summon that effectively. Everybody evolving perhaps his or her own language to do that, or image, or symbol, symbols. Let not being escape. Nothing escapes me. Nothing escapes me. Nothing escapes me. Escapes being me. Nothing escapes. Nothing can escape. In the right stage of realization, nothing can escape being me. Nothing can escape being the fact, the presence, the essence, the substance, the one. No escape for any content of consciousness. And all there is in the universe is contents of consciousness anyway, contents of self-consciousness, really, because there's one universal logos perceiving itself, as I see it. So every being is a self-perception of the universal logos. And nothing can escape being in that one all-containing perception. Everything is an aspect of that one all-containing perception. Brother externalization. You as me. And then, of course, to bless. I sometimes discover that I may realize the oneness of all things, fleetingly, perhaps. They call it sometimes the blinking of the dragon's eye, the dragon of wisdom. Now, maybe the dragon has his eyes closed most of the time, but I open the eye and close. And then, oh, wow, suddenly the dragon blinked his eye. But the blinking is the opening rather than the closing. So rather than being in a state of open eye all the time, it's mostly in a state of closed eye, at least the dragon as we experience it. But then that eye will open and close, until it opens and stays open, or longer. The blinking of the dragon's eye. And then the oneness impresses itself, the identical substantiality of all things. I've begun to call it, this thing, the substanding. Sometimes you use a gerund like that, you know, participle, as a noun. The substanding. I'm very partial to that these days. Blessings on you in the substanding. Blessings on everyone in the substanding. We can start with human beings and go to lower kings of nature or great planetary logoi, solar logoi. It's all an expression of the substanding. We could say the substanding one, but for me, it's more evocative when I use the word the substanding. So, I try to bless people on a good day. Blessings on you. I know that there is no, you know, you and I and all that, but the form of words seems to get the energy flowing. Blessings on you in the substanding. As the substanding. Boyops. no language we know. Blessings on you as the substanding. Substanding one. And I find that rather than simply realize the identicality, searching for love within it, and so forth, the act of blessing is very powerful. It's not like blessing any quality particularly. It's the affirmation of the beingness of the other, the affirmation of the immortality, immutability, indispensability, irreplaceability, inextinguishability, ineradicability, indestructibility. Invincibility of the other. Blessing. You know, it's not may all this go well for you and may your plans be fulfilled. Okay, that too. May you be glorified. May the glory come to you. This fulfillment in glory. Of course, but the blessing is may the being that you are essentially emerge into your consciousness. May the fact that you are forever, as the fact you are forever the fact, may that emerge and be realized. That kind of blessing. Everybody already is the perfect, and that deeper sense. And in the world of relativity, we have to work out a relative perfection in this hierarchical world and within the context of good and evil and in the context of self-limitation, because the whole universe is a great limitation upon the self, in a way. But when you bless, you know, blessings on you as the substanding, in the substanding, as the substanding, blessings on you. You affirm the deepest essence of the individual and the fact that they cannot escape from being who they are, which is the ultimate, the infinite ultimate. They are that already, forever, beyond the world of relativity. So blessings are needed in the world of relativity, of course, and may the soul emerge, and may the design of your soul be manifested, and may the word and name which you and your monad carry be manifested in perfection. And all of that is needed, absolutely, and we must not ignore the relativity, which is the ever-recurring Maya, infinitely recurring, according to the exhalation of the great breath. We can never ignore that, and we must work for the good within the world of relativity and not for evil. But the blessing on you, brother, externalization. Blessings on you in the substanding, brother, externalization. Blessings on you as the substanding, brother, externalization. All things the same. Yes, of course, we're still capable of seeing the difference, of course. Forever, in the world of Maya, we do that. And we work towards the good, the will to good. And underneath it all, we know that there is no difference. Difference has to be an ultimate illusion, a necessary illusion, forever, periodically. But we remember the sameness. the inescapable sameness of substance, in the sense that I use that word, the inescapable sameness of God, in its infinite variety, so the paradox is there, but essentially the same. Same another. That's all consisting of same another. Now we have a mind full of other. We have a mind full of distinction. We never awaken from the other. Lives and lives and lives preoccupied with the other. But what about the same? And when we begin to realize the pervasion of the same, pervasion of the presence, of the fact, of the essence, of the self, of the synthesis, of the substance. When that starts to be a driving compulsion within these consciousness in which spirit is awakening to itself, you can't resist it, you know. You can't resist it. You have to go with it so that it can find its way as a permanent state of realization. Now, remember, intensities of realization of the One, ever deepening. I don't for a minute imagine that nirvana is it. What is it said in the Evans Wentz book, Nirvana is but the beginning of the endless way? I think that the ultimate infinite realization only occurs when the universe is apparently not. In that state of infinitescence, I call it, that state of all in allness, that state of infinite infinitude, whatever, then there is the realization of the ultimate. And who is to say what transpires? I mean, you have to drop your words at that point. Everything in universe is a limitation upon that ultimate perception. Meanwhile, we have the Maya cyclically forever. Every universe is a Maya. Mayavic definiteness. A Mayavic one. A one. Whenever there's a one, there's a Maya. And when we say the one infinite being, we don't mean to make it definite. It is the least describable of all things. It's not a thing at all. It's been called the no thing. Some little reflection of that ground of all being is what we strive for. And we choose to recognize that we are all externalizations of that indescribability. And that there's a great commonality, a great sameness, a great identicality operating all the time, inescapable, except to our fluctuating consciousness, which escapes it all the time. And that we cannot tolerate for too much longer, right? This identicality which looks for the that rather than the what first. That looks for life rather than quality first. That isolates the unity and dwells as the presence in all form. This is the object, the subject. This is the consciousness we seek to persist. And when it said, I still persist under the first ray, that's what persists, this sense of life, and the sense that I am that life which persists. I have to, a debt of gratitude to my old teacher, Andrew McIver. Every time I think of him, I get choked up. But, you know, there I was, a young student at the University of Michigan, and this man literally saved my life, my spiritual life. Met him one day on the way to a dance rehearsal, fourth-ray stuff. Never got Never got to the rehearsal, and my life changed. So he had like six planets in Pisces and Leo rising, and the one thing he knew, really knew, he said, there are 10,000 things I don't know, but of the essence I am sure, of the main point I am sure. That main point was identification. What an astrological setup for identification. Whoa. Well, my relatives figured he ruined my life, and I figured he saved it. You know, you can only be an intellectual Jewish skeptic for so long, then you run into an embodiment of wisdom, and you're dead in your old form. So anyway, identification. And, you know, I have books full of this stuff. And I realize I'm speaking slowly, maybe too slowly for some, but it's the only way that I can be spontaneous about it, you know, and try to share with you the things that these days I think are quite important. Oh yes, I will go on with this astrology, and I want to do the old commentaries and, you know, meticulously talk about the meaning of all these things, which is my duty, as long as I can draw breath, to do. But every once in a while, I want to deviate from the prescribed program and share with you, brother externalization, share with you these deeper thoughts and impressions I realize, not systematically, but in a way as they occur to me, maybe ponderously, pondering their deeper meaning and hoping that you can share with me some of the impression of the deeper meaning of these incipient realizations, which I expect to deepen almost infinitely throughout the progress of unveiling, which will occur in universe until every one of us are in consciousness the one universal logos we already are. And then we will disappear into that which we have forever been. At least that's how I see it. It's a pretty bright future. It's beyond good and evil. Nobody's left out. The bad ones, the good ones, it's all resolved eventually into beingness. The one being. And my experience is yours and yours is mine. And if you've been bad and I've been good, I've been bad and you've been good. So... that's inevitable, that there's only one experience going on here. And one being is the experiencer. Self-experiencer, really. Involved in a self-reflected universal experience. Well, you know, I think my wife is expecting me to see a good movie on TV, something that reminds me of the quality of love. And so, you know, it's about an hour and a half of discussion here. I'm not sure how this is all going to turn out with such a heavy demand on the video aspect of it, but let's see. And I'll keep this up occasionally. I'll look in my little black book number 3. I guess I've been doing black books. Well, when I went to the Dalai Lama 2 years ago, this coming July, I must have filled up 7 books, writing furiously as the impressions came while the Dalai Lama was saying what for me were unintelligible things, but the energy was there and I was able to, you know, deal with these factors. And I have to reread them and, you know, will one ever get a chance to do that? But I was in it, and I'm sure many were, because it was such a great energy field generated that whatever your own tendency towards enlightenment was, you could get into it. You may not have known the Tibetan language in this life, but the field was generated. So I've got a number of these little books, and probably three really significant to me anyway, little black books. Because like I say, in there, like the telephone number of God, you might say. Got these numbers. I love some kind of mathematics which is beyond my ability. But I get the intuition of it. And it's all about reducing everything to nothing. Or at least to the absolute infinitesimal. I'll talk a little bit more about that at some point, about how we are no further from the beginningless beginning, and we can never get any closer to the endless end. It's almost like you're riveted in the eternal now. Can't move off the now. I'll talk about that a little bit at some point in these ontological ramblings. But I wouldn't be fair to myself or to you if I tried to organize what I'm going to say. Because then it wouldn't be maybe as spontaneous or as daring as I hope it to be. And we'll see. I'll do some of these rather slow-paced discussions, dwelling meditatively on certain words of power and invented words and perceptions, realizing this is coming from my point of view of a tiny little extension of that, and hoping that there's enough commonality, enough in my perceptions to be useful to you as you seek similarly to prove the fact, prove to yourself the fact. It's only one fact to me, one fact. We all have to find the proof of it in our own way. How can I therefore demonstrate this fact? What shall I do? I wander in illusion. Well, let's find a way to negate the illusion. As we have ever done, cyclically forever, comes a time when the illusion, at least the process of negating it, must be begun. Okay, well, I just have to stop. And I'll try to send this along to you under what title, I don't know. It's in a way Adventures in Identification number 10. I haven't any idea what I said in the earlier ones, and maybe some of the same ideas. But it helps for us to ponder together. Slowly. These deeper, more penetrating realizations which help to dissolve the illusion, dissolve into the substanding, dissolve into the substanding, merge in the substanding, merge as the substanding, melt into as the substanding, be, brother, externalization, the substanding. And I'll just leave it at that with a single om. And we will see you again, inevitably forever. Be you again. Be you always. Whether in this format or another, more academic. Inevitably.